Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Craig. I'm back with a player profile episode. It's been about 2 years since I posted one of these, so apologies if there's been anybody out there that's been hanging out for an episode. You know, COVID made things in-person interviews really tricky, and then just dad life and work in general has just been really busy lately, and I just kind of lost the enthusiasm to do these. But I'm back. I've got this one, this episode coming out just now, obviously, that you're listening to with Doug Wimbish. And there's another one in the bag already, which will be out in a couple of weeks. So yeah, I'll try and pop these out whenever is appropriate. You know, no regularity to it, but I definitely appreciate anybody that listens to these. And yeah, this one with Doug Wimbish is pretty exciting for me. I've been a fan of Doug's since I was in my early teens. Stain was hugely inspirational for me as an album, an ear-opening in terms of sonics, what was possible on the instrument, and you know, as a band in that genre, Living Colour, just epic. So it was great to be able to ask Doug some questions surrounding all that stuff. Yeah, so Living Colour were in town on tour with Extreme, another kind of teenage idol band for me. So they were doing like a double bill, and the show was amazing. Just all the tunes you'd want. And the day before, Doug Wimbish and Will Calhoun, the drummer from Living Colour, they did like a masterclass, which was put on very kindly and expertly by the good people at Bay Centre CMI Audio. Shout out to Stephen Lane. And it was hosted at JMC Academy in Melbourne. So it was great to be, you know, up close and personal with Doug and hearing him tell stories and stuff as well. So that was an epic masterclass. And then, you know, he sat down with me for another 45 minutes for this interview. So, you know, you could tell he's pretty tired. He's been on tour. They were in New Zealand or all over the place. But, you know, he still took time to answer the questions, and, you know, he was super, super kind and generous with his time. It was really great. So, yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Please spread the word and enjoy this interview with the incredible Doug Wimbish. My name is Craig. This is Bass Lessons Melbourne, and today I have the honour of being joined by Doug Wimbish.
Hey.
He's here with Living Colour. Doug.
Craig, pleasure to meet you.
Ah, and you, man. It's an honour to have this time with you. I know you've got a busy schedule. You're down here with Living Colour, obviously, doing a double headline with Extreme.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
That's been great.
Yeah.
You know, we started off in the States, did a month. Came down here and continuing the good vibe. We also played in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Auckland with just Living Colour. So it's been a great run. Both bands are very compatible. Nuno's fantastic. The combination of Living Colour and Extreme works.
Yeah. Have you guys done stuff in the past? Have you crossed? No.
Vernon and Nuno did a camp that Tom Morello organized, and that was a moment that helped spark this moment right now.
Okay.
So, but it's been really, really good. Both bands, the combination of the two, the sum of that is just good music.
And big audiences.
Oh yeah.
People are turning up.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome. Sellouts and good vibes, people are happy, and it's a great, great musical experience. Check it out.
As soon as I saw it announced, tickets went on sale, I grabbed it, because
Stain and Porno Graffiti were two of the albums that I listened to a lot. So I'm excited. I wanted to kick off asking you a little bit about your experience with Jeff Beck, because obviously we lost him tragically recently.
Yeah, it was a tough one.
Yeah.
Tough. Well, it was Jeff Beck that really elevated me in the to another level. Being able to be a part of his band with Simon Phillips and Jan Hammer was
a wonderful
experience. Just to be around Jeff, his organization, to be able to perform those shows. Jimmy Hall was singing vocals from that whole experience was just great. I think about our gigs in Japan, and it's just one moment in time.
Yeah.
It was Jeff that was able to get me into the door of Mick Jagger and right. into the ears of other folks that were maybe not familiar with what I was doing as a bassist. When you play with Jeff, it just gives you some good credentials.
For sure, yes. I mean, yeah.
And it's a highlight, you know, that really opened my eyes up to the industry on another level.
Mm.
And I still learning to this day how to be able to stay involved in the industry
yeah.
on that level. So thanks, Jeff, and the knowledge I learned from him is a
And musically,
it's great.
He's such a kind of free spirit, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you felt like you resonated with him on?
It just naturally happened. You know, I did his Flash record. It was Arthur Baker that basically brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
One thing led to another. But when I actually got to in his band and with Simon and Jan, I understood how the people that Jeff had chose to be a part of his band, how involved they were. Like Simon was very involved. He was kind of like the one that was kind of keeping everything in play. And
mm-hmm.
I followed his lead. And Jan Hammer was just phenomenal. Jeff and Jan just having that ongoing conversation was, you know, it was a true life experience. So, but to watch him play, with how he approaches the instrument, just watching, I learned a lot about finding your individual way of presenting tones and sounds. Find your way. Jeff had that individual frequency that only Jeff Beck could do. And learned a lot. You know, he didn't necessarily play with a pick. His technique was quite unique.
Mm.
And there's nobody on that I had met and probably will ever meet that had that kind of frequency.
Yeah.
Playing with that style.
So. Yeah, he's sadly missed for sure.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And then another guitar player that I wanted to ask you about, a big favorite of mine, your time with Joe Satriani. I know he was influential in giving you the whammy pedal
yep.
in that
yep.
journey. But The Extremist was one of my favorite albums that Joe did.
Yeah.
There's just so many beautiful melodies on that.
Yeah.
What was that experience like
well,
for you?
Well, there was, you know, I met Joe at the NAMM show in Chicago. Must have been 1980. Was it? Maybe 86.
Not too long ago.
I got to get my time. Okay, it was like around 1986. Anyway, from the time we hooked up, it was always cool. Joe was a huge fan of my band Tackhead.
Right.
From over in the UK. He's a huge fan. He was living in San Francisco. So that started, that just kind of kicked it off. And next thing you know, come to some Tackhead shows. And Tackhead hat, he wore that hat for a while. And
nice.
Anyway, and I kind of helped usher Joe in when Jeff Beck decided he didn't want to be a part of, you know, leave Mick Jagger's solo band. I had recommended Joe as a guitar player. And it took a minute for folks to come around, and finally, you know, things aligned, and next thing you know, Joe's in the band. So we both had that opportunity to experience at that level working with Mick Jagger and the machine that's in play. And also Joe was connected with Bill Graham and Mick Brigden. So there was that, there's a good frequency. After the tour with Mick, I got invited to play on Mick's, on Joe's solo record. And that was with Simon, parts of the band, Phil Ashley. And that was a great experience. We recorded that record in Bearsville up in Woodstock, New York. And mm-hmm. it was one of those great experiences. You know, Joe's very engaged in the songs and it's he's just one of those players that's so deep, so good that you find a way how to give a person like Joe the frequencies that he needs. So for example, you know, we're doing some of the demos, he already played bass on it, precision bass with a pick. His sweeping is second to none. Learned a lot about playing with a pick by emulating some of the stuff that Joe did on demos. Okay. And watching and seeing how he approached it. The spacing, the rhythm, where he's angling the pick, where it's positioned. Is the pick near the bridge? Is he, you know, how's his hands? Where's his right hand positioned? You know, and you learn from watching and seeing people play. So whether it's a guitar player, bass player, it doesn't matter. He was nailing the part. I wanted to give him exactly what he wanted. So had fun making that record. And he's a lifelong friend.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Good friend to have.
Yeah, lifelong friend.
Yeah. So were you actually playing with a pick or kind of doing pick style sounds with the fingers?
Depending on what the song was.
Yeah.
Some songs were ballads just playing with, you know, finger style, but there was one song, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a very articulate, had to be played with a pick. Precision was the instrument to play it with.
Yeah.
Because it had that groove. Mm. And it had that swing. And it's almost like certain players just, when they play with a pick or their fingers, they have a certain swagger. Like Bobby Vega, classic example, great bass player. He can play with a pick, he can play with his fingers. He's got that perfect, you know, San Francisco swagger when he's playing. And Joe had a very unique swagger when he was playing bass with a pick. I liked it.
Yeah.
And it was a lesson for me to be able to duplicate what he had.
Mm. Yeah.
To add anything else sometimes, just play.
You know, it's often said a sign of a good player is how well they play a shuffle, and
yeah.
Joe's shuffle is epic.
You know, Satch Boogie is a great song, and we had the opportunity to play that live when we were both with Mick. Joe had a moment. It was just Simon, Joe, and myself.
Oh,
so.
Cool.
I was so happy to have that moment to play with Joe and Simon during Mick Jagger's solo tour. It was great.
Yeah.
So, you know, and here we are right now. He's still in the game. He's still doing his thing. He's still on top of his game.
Yeah.
And
as are you guys.
Well, you know, it's just if you can sustain yourself through this, through life, you know, you have the opportunity to wake up and continue to do something that you love.
Yeah.
And be around people that, you know, that you're friends with. And you know, I don't take that, you know, lightly. So Joe's a great friend. Always look forward to seeing him. We always have fun. And I owe him a new tackhead hat.
Like, so how have you navigated balancing the Sideman session world and your commitment to being in a band, you know? And sometimes those lines can maybe be a little bit blurred.
If you blur them yourself.
Right.
Sometimes need to be blurred. If the lines are drawn with ink, it's hard to erase ink. If it's drawn with chalk, it's a little bit easier. If you present yourself in a way of being honest, then you don't have to worry about your lines being blurred. You're being honest and you're being able to, you commit to things that you know, and you follow the commitment. Mm. also, you find a way how to present yourself so that people can respect what you're doing and you respect what they're doing. And don't get pulled into something that you know you can't do or fulfill. Stay honest. There's plenty of players out here. Hook up some of your mates if you can't do something. You got to survive in this industry. So I grew up as a studio musician. There's a start right there. I grew up playing with bands. I built my career off of putting myself in situations that I was uncomfortable with to become comfortable and working with outside of necessarily the same structured music. And that being said, I invested in the next generation. So a person that's 16, I'm playing and helping them out just like anybody else that might be older than them. It's just kind of, it's music, and you find your community, you find your family, you embrace it, and you just stay honest and real. And some folks can either deal with the fact that you might say, hey, I'll cut some songs for you, but I can't join the band. Or I'll help in a way where I can maybe find a platform, find other musicians that can balance things up. Because it's cycles, man. You know, something happens, you have, you know, somebody wants you to do a record, you do the record, there's hope and promise, and the next thing you know, it blows up. And then it goes to a whole other level. Mm. And I've been a part of that. Then the other things is it doesn't turn out the way that you might have expected it to turn out, but it's still, but you did it. You still got the job done. So as I learn, I try to share that knowledge with folks that are on the come up and be able to give them some support for both sides of the coin. Have a life while you're doing these records. Be prepared for the left and the right to come together, or the left to stay left and the right to stay separate for a long time, and find a way how to deal with that. That means sometimes things work out when you're doing a project, sometimes things don't. Doesn't is when things can collapse. That's when the blame game starts. Mm. So no, just, you know, be kind and be mindful that these are just moments in time. If you stay stuck in pause, that's on you. But if you find a way how to continue to stay fluid and move forward, then that's a learning experience, and you can carry the negative or positive frequencies over to the next spot if you choose to or not. You know, but and what I've learned is just answer the phone. Don't avoid folk. If you're going to do a job, be prepared. Go in prepared. Don't put yourself above or below somebody else's vibe. Give a person what they want. Do your research. Mm-hmm. It's like a magician. A magician will have to, in order for him to pull those tricks off, he has to practice it a lot. Mm-hmm. You know? So practice how you approach and deal with the situations at hand, and also make sure that your execution is from the heart and you can give a person what they need. And it's not all about notes all the time. That's part of it. Sometimes people just need a hug. Mm-hmm. You need to have a conversation with somebody so that they can, you know, they can get through a moment where there's a spark that can create a new song or a new idea, or it's something that you see there's some yellow cards or yellow lights flashing. Hang on a minute, let's pull it back a little bit.
Yeah.
So to me, how do I navigate? All of those things are part of the industry. You know, making the songs and doing all of that stuff are easy. It's all to a point.
Yeah.
To a point. But it's all of the yin 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 yin, all the other things that goes on, that can, that can make things challenging. And I've learned, I'm still learning how to just, you know, walk between those sonic raindrops, watch out for the laser beams, and that's how I survive, just by, you know, being honest with everybody. Maybe I can do this tour. I'm not holding the line to be greedy. I got this gig. It's mine. Nothing's mine. If I can do that, cool. If not, then there's many other folks that I'd like to see doing that. I'm in Living Color. I'm also in Tackhead. Mm-hmm. I have my own band. Will and I have Head Fake. We have Jungle Funk. Some things are active, some things aren't active. There's Little Axe, there's Bernard Fowler that I work with, there's a Adrian Sherwood. I can go down a list of all these active cells, right, that are just there. Some have transitioned, but their frequencies are still there. So I guess I've just been able to be around people that understand how to enjoy life, make records, and also avoid some folks that are just, you know, that have don't have, let's just say, good human skills. You know, just sometimes you just need basic human skills to survive, get the call. Mm. But also avoid some of the things that you know are gonna, that's just, you know, you don't necessarily have to, you don't have to loot those frequencies anymore. You can see it, and some things you can help out a person, other things you can't. So I just keep it real. I'm like, hey, it's, you know, people will send me songs, I'm happy to play on them.
Yeah.
Happy to help somebody out. And that's life to me. You know, I don't have sometimes it's not about a number. It's about help that person. Help them. As opposed to, well, you gotta pay me this, that, and the other. It's, you know, if the money's there, fine. Mm-hmm. If it's not, it's more than fine. Because I'm happy where I am. I've done enough music to know that I'm not dependent on sticking that person up for whatever to make a record. You know, so that's a good place. I'm in a good place. I'm happy to be in that place. So that's how I deal with it, by show by example. Don't watch listen, process, help and assist, and keep it moving.
Yeah. So Stain is obviously a massive album in your career and Living Colour's career. And when it came out, what was it, 96?
93.
I remember seeing it, not in 93, a little bit later on, but I remember seeing the video for Auslander on this. It was like a heavy metal,
video show, right?
Yeah. And so it was kind of, you know, in between Metallica and Megadeth and stuff, and then Auslander came on, and it just whipped my head around, you know, because I was starting to get into bass as well, and I had this groove and this kind of undertone that was different from everything else. And so I wanted to ask you about, like, did you guys have a plan or a goal for Stain? Like, you know, you've got songs like Bye on there and a whole, you know, really heavy topics that other bands that you were kind of being associated with weren't really dealing with, but here you are with all of this stuff wrapped up in an amazing package.
Well, it's a good question. When I got in the band was now going into another phase of their career, but it was also kind of continuing in the realm of what Living Color is all about, which is diversity.
Yeah.
All of the records have been unique. Is there a consistent pattern? Is there throughout the theme of all Living Color records? Yeah, the consistency is things being different, in a sense. Cult is cult, you know? And then now you move on to Time's Up, and Time's Up had its frequencies, but then you had A Love Raises Its Ugly Head, you know, or Solace of You. Mm. Now it's time, 93, it's a different frequency happening right now in America. You know, the Seattle scene is kicking in, like you said. There's stuff coming from Nirvana and Metallica is on the rise, and Megaforce and whatever. But the thing is, Living Color has always been a band that has been part, it's like these chapters of what's happening at the moment. We're like the news with the beat. At that moment, I'm in the band. At that moment, there's a different mindset of what's going on, but it's still following from the same gene pool of what was happening, where it all started, which really boils down to Vernon. Vernon put the band together, and it was his concept and his primary songs that set the pace for Living Color. And over time, how Vernon Will, Corey, and Muzzy help translate those songs is how things evolve. When I got in the band, it was, you know, which Will got me in the band, it was now another, the band is evolving again. I bought a sense of experience when it comes to certain things, you know, and frequencies when it comes to certain things. So we were able to get together and start from frequencies and ideas to get to where what came up, what became Stain. And it's just like, it's not like anything else. Get in the room, work it out, play some ideas. Vernon might have had some ideas, chop it up. Maybe I add this or take away from that or whatever. So you just gotta start. And that's what we did. We had a space in Queens, we go there during the week, we'd work things out, we'd log information, so on and so forth. That went on, that was a process. Then we auditioned, there were different producers that we were fortunate enough to meet and greet and hang out with, and then Ron St. Germain became the producer for that project. But we were able to make connections with some of the other producers and do other things with them as well. So it was a sequence of events, repetition, ideas, where the state of the country was and the world was in at that time. Again, like the news with the beat. So you're talking a song like Bye, you know, it's very unique. You know, some people don't want to talk about those things. Living Color has been that band that, you know, hey, let's have that conversation. Yeah. You know, Ignorance is Bliss, let's have that conversation. Wall, let's have that conversation. So it became, some people could say it was a darker period, and so on and so forth. To me, it was a wonderful period. It was a wonderful moment in time for myself and Living Color to be able to continue to make music, as opposed to that could have easily got knocked on the head. Maybe the Living Color would have been just Vivid Times Up and Biscuits. You never know how things unfold with bands. But I knew Vernon, for a while, and was friends with him, and he'd come and hang out at Keith LeBlanc's house in his place down in New York. And before Will and Corey met him, we were mates. So there's a synergy that was already there. There was a frequency that was happening. And we just, you know, there was energy that was already in place. I was, you know, fortunate enough to be able to connect Mick and Living Color with Vernon and so on and so forth. But that's all on the side. So the energy started to move forward, and Stain was produced. Stain is the baby that came out of that. And it was, in my opinion, it was how things unfold in life. Sometimes what you're familiar with at that time becomes, you know, when you start to do something that might be a little bit different, it takes a minute for you to understand what was happening at that particular time. Maybe you have to, if you can live 10 years later, you can look back and go,
hindsight.
You know, you start to understand, hang on a minute, I love this, but now I can understand why y'all did that. And that's what you hope happens for some folks, a discovery, or those that are like, those that are real hardcore fans that maybe like certain things, and then they come back and go, you know what? I was so engaged in what I wanted to hear, I couldn't accept what was happening at that time. But now I can, because I get it. I've matured, or my ego, you know, it's been of what I wanted y'all to be has come down now. Maybe I got kids, and maybe I got something else that's going on. Now I can listen to it with a freer head than that kid that was in the dorm.
Yeah.
So Stain is that record that, in my opinion, was essential to happen. And I'm glad I was there to make it, because now as I listen back, it's like a work of art. All of the Living Color records are great, but the sound of that record is very unique.
Yeah.
And the mixing that Ron St. Germain did all made sense. The aggressive approach and the actual beauty of what took place was, we crafted that quite well.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Absolutely.
in my opinion. When you listen to it, it sounds just as fresh today, in my opinion, as it did then. It's how you sequence a record. It's the band became more mature. The band had been on the road. Now you can settle and you can start to dive into some other frequencies, because that's the kind of band Living Color has always been. It's an experimental band. Mm. We've learned from, you know, you've learned from what's around. You follow the frequencies, or you just continue to, you know, deliver certain things that are comfortable. And if that's the band that you're in, fine. Living Color isn't that band.
Yeah.
No. There you have it.
Yeah.
So staying was great.
Totally. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the cover songs that you guys do. I mean, we're in Australia, and I know on one of the albums you did a cover of Back in Black.
Yeah.
How does the cover songs things come up?
Oh, we're just taking a piss. We could be having a conversation. All of a sudden, why don't we do that? It happens that quick.
Right.
It's just like, okay, what about that? Maybe we're on a bus and we heard Back in Black. Man, that would be great to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just do it. You know, it's like, it's as simple as that.
Cool.
It's as simple as that. A lot of things come, spirit of the moment, do it. Does it make sense? Probably not. But we do it.
And you guys are all capable enough of kind of swinging all kinds of different directions musically.
That was a day or 2 days tops.
Yeah.
That was something that took place, and maybe we just went over it a couple of times and everybody learned the parts and off we go.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of Living Color. We'll go, okay, let's shift. Okay, what about that, okay, let's go.
Yeah.
And you figure it out and you cut it probably the same day or the next day.
Does that filter into the live shows as well?
Oh, yeah. The live shows really, really work out good for us now, because we take some of the songs and we've been able to work out arrangements that happen by what somebody would call a mistake. Playing live is the best frequency for, you know, to be able to have, to get things popping. So our live presentation of certain songs is wonderful, in my opinion, because we've managed to make these moments happen that everybody goes, oh yeah, that's cool. Oh no, man, that's kind of crazy, but I like that. Well, let's use that craziness there, you know? So without us playing live, we wouldn't have the frequency that we have when we go on stage now. There's some songs that are played kind of the way they are, and other songs have been kind of put together because we jammed them out on stage.
Mm.
And we've maybe at the end of a song, we came up with a certain groove and then we insert that someplace. I don't even know how it happens.
Yeah.
It just happens. Now, you know, and that's the beauty of it. Because
the music kind of tells you where to go.
Some things just happen and it sticks. And we've come up with these different little arrangements. So, and that's what's good, because we don't really rehearse anymore. To a point, if you don't know the music by now, Jesus Christ, what's going on here, mate? So if you wanna rehearse to the point of like, yo, man, you made a mistake and all that stuff, come on. So what brings life to it is the fact that Will might miss a beat, but I'll try to clean it up. But then that means that the next time it happens, maybe that, you know, there's something that's in there. Why did he do that? And I'll join in, and then we'll take that piece and join that to the main frame of something.
Yeah.
So all these nice little things that somebody calls a mistake, they're not mistakes to me, unless it's very obvious. You know what I mean? You know, some things are like, okay, you're playing. We're playing four different keys. You know what I mean? But you know, the bottom line is that's Living Color. You know, we're an organic band. Play in the moment. We challenge each other.
Mm.
We're having more conversations about, you know, whatever's going on. The next thing you know, we go on stage and have fun. We're not necessarily getting our wig twisted because of this, that, or the other. If there's anything that we deal with, that we're challenged with, is what songs are we going to play and how are we going to sequence our show on that. So.
And maybe we could quickly talk a little bit about gear. How did Spectre come into your life, and why is it kind of stuck with you? Why is it kind of you're kind of synonymous with
good question.
Bases.
Well, I was introduced to Spectre by way of Aaron Mills from Cameo. When I saw him play Spectre bass back in 1980, 81, when Sugar Hill Gang was out on the road with Rick James, or, you know, we sued these big festivals. Anyway, so I saw him playing a Spector bass, and I was like, wow, that sounds great. It was a passive Spector bass, but it sounded great. We're playing arenas and stadiums, and all, it just had that to it. So that was the beginning. And then fast forward, you know, I would see a Spector bass and Guitar Player magazine. I couldn't afford one. You know, so I was just happy to maintain my Fender Jazz. So I got hooked up with Spector by way of Jeff Beck. Again, it was a default.
Wow.
Spector was now acquired by, went from, well, put it like this, Spector went from being a boutique company in Brooklyn to being acquired by what was the name of that brand? Eddie Van Halen's guitar, Kramer.
Kramer.
Kramer bought out, you know, Spector for a moment. And now I'm with Mick Jagger, and we're doing a recording for his second solo record. Jeff and I are doing the working with Mick. And Jeff's a hot item. So, you know, wherever Jeff would go, people would just show up with guitars, and, you know, it's kind of crazy. So anyway, one day, word got out that guys from Kramer wanted to show Jeff some guitars. And he showed up to SIR with a bunch of guitars. And Jeff kind of checked them out, you know, nice color, you know, and he kind of was, you know, he just kind of moved on because, you know, he's into what he's into, right? It's kind of an interesting moment. Pierre de Beaupart was the kind of person that brought some of these things together, and a guy by the name of Jim Barber, if I remember right. Anyway, they were techs that were working with Mick. So at that moment when Jeff saw the guitars, kind of kept moving. It was kind of like a silent moment. You know, you come in, you got all these guitars. Hey, Jeff, check out the guitars. And then Jeff comes in. Wow, man. That was nice. Nice color. Okay. And he kept going. I was like, oh. So then there was that moment of silence for 10 seconds that sounded like an eternity. Spector was now part of Kramer. So Pierre de Beaupart was like, hey, Dougie's interested in your Spector basses. And that's exactly how it happened. So at that time, because I'm working with Mick Jagger, so that, you know, that was a key. Mm. Working with Jeff Beck, that was a key. Spector was still in the come up. They wasn't like, okay, yeah, we're going to put you on and blah, 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 blah. They had like a loner bass that, okay, you're interested in playing the Spector bass?
They didn't trust you yet.
Here, use a loner bass. Let's see how it works out for you. So I got the loner bass, immediately started recording with it. You know, the neck was a bit big, but it sounded great. It was, you know, PJ configuration, HasLab preamp. It was killer. Mm-hmm. Mick liked it. The engineers liked it. Everything with the producer liked it, Keith Diamond, and so on and so forth. So that started the ball rolling. Because I'm working with Mick, they let me hold on to the bass because we're recording the record. It's a good look for them. It's a good look for me. So then that turned into, okay, you know, Mick Jagger's got a solo tour coming up. Another good look. Hey, Doug, now we'd like to make a bass for you. What do you want? So that's how it started. Jeff Beck was the spark. Mick Jagger was the lure. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, making the records. Everybody liked the sound. Next thing you know, fast forward, I'm in Neptune, New Jersey, and with Stuart Spector, and we're measuring up necks and doing so on and so forth. So, yeah, I got to thank Jeff. I got to thank Mick. I got to thank the actual techs that were behind the scenes pushing it through. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I was really digging the Spector basses. So started there. I asked when I was presented with the opportunity to have some instruments made for me, I requested to Stuart if he could shave the neck down to make it a little more like a jazz bass neck. And he did. Took a minute, but he did, so that's the four string I have out there right now, and it made the body a little more unique and so on. Then I got a five string from him, and he had just started making five string. Well, maybe, let's just say, let me rephrase that. He was early in the game of making five string basses. This is 1987. Got a five string, then he made a four, fretless and a four string with two jazz pickups in it. And so in other words, I had four key Golden Era Spector basses, the two that are out there right now, which is a five string with two jazz pickups. And back then, the EMG didn't have five string pickups. So they were using like four string rear pickups with one element. And right. That's what's on my basses. That's what made it sound. That's why that bass has that unique sound. It's not individual. The pickups aren't individual poles. It's one element.
Right.
Two rear jazz pickups. So there's
so
that.
So that it fit across the strings.
Yep. So they fit straight across the strings. And, you know, just I learned a lot over the years of the of what went into making those instruments, because as time progressed, things changed. But that's how it started, man. And once you find an instrument that sounds that good and it's made well, you're in the studio, you don't have to, there's no buzz happening now. You don't have to, you know, turn over. When I was in New York City, you'd put alligator clips on the bridge, take a wire, put that to the knee desk or whatever. I'm in New York, I have to face away from the Empire State Building, you know, it's crazy, but that's what used to take place. Now, I could just play without a lot of buzz going on.
Yeah. So, and you know every inch of those basses, you know how to get all the sound.
You know every inch of those basses, and those are very unique. Those are unique instruments, so in time things change, and I'm an old school head. I like the old school Gumby head stocks, and the Spector first came out with, and I'm looking forward to moving the dial with some of Doug Wimbish versions that are going to come out that are going to bring back the old school traditional vibe.
Nice.
Because it's needed.
Yeah.
Totally.
One last question.
Yep.
If you could jump back in time and give young Doug a bit of advice, what would that be?
I would say, that's a very good question. You know, I would say, Keep following your dreams. You're gonna get there, as long as you're happy with whatever you're doing. And that's all I ever did. And now here I am right now. I followed my dreams. Things didn't come easy. It wasn't like things were gifted. You know, I had to work for it.
Yeah.
It came from hard work, sacrifice, family, friends. I put countless hours into this craft and doing things. I'm very dedicated. And there was times when, you know, you can get engaged in certain things that will sidetrack you, but you have to make sure that that's why there's a reset button that everybody has, if you know how to hit it, to stay focused and you'll get there. So that would be the advice, because I followed my heart. I didn't get tangled up with being a part of any one particular crew. Music is endless, and it has, and it's infinite. So I let the music take my mind where I needed to go. I learned by being around people that gave me inspiration. I learned by being around people that gave me negative frequencies and could still stay positive. So if, go back to young Doug, stay the course. Mm. Have an open heart. Don't change anything. Just make sure you show up for yourself. Don't get drunk on the illusion of what this industry can produce. Find a way how to survive and stay in love with this music, just like I did when I first started off. I love playing music. I get up every day, I have the same love for it. And that's what I love right now. So, I'm thankful that Doug was able to drive to this Doug right now. And, you know, the road hasn't been straight, but you know what? Every curve, I've learned something. Don't go that way, go this way. I got to back up a little bit. Okay, hang on a minute. So, you know, now I got to back up so I can figure out which, you know, I can have a better look at which way to go. But, dude, it's been a hell of a ride, but it's been a good one, man. I look at all the folks that I've been able to meet, and they're not all musicians or players. It's just like, but the diversity of what I've been able to do from doing all the Sugar Hill stuff to being involved with Tackhead, being at the forefront of industrial music and, you know, and doing things with the same crew, Keith LeBlanc, Skip McDonald, Adrian Sherwood, Bernard Fowler. You know, I made a lot of music, not by myself, but with friends. I'm not the architect, I'm the recipient, for years before I got involved with Living Color. And it's all of that that never stopped. It wasn't like I joined Living Color, everything else is out the window. No. Everything enhanced. The same folks that I was working with, I bought into the Living Color camp. The same folks from Living Color camp, I would introduce to other folks that I've had that experience with. That's life. That's how you can stay excited, by just making those connections and not kind of like acting like, oh, now I got this connection, so now I'm cool, or I'm, you know, okay, that person that I knew before, look at how I look now, check me out. No. Let's all eat. Let's all get some of this knowledge and this in this love. So that's what Doug is the same, pretty much same DNA to the core, because I'm still doing the same things. I'm still trying to hook folks up. I'm still learning. I'm still learning and I'm still playing catch up for some of the things that I spent a lot of time in this craft, and then sometimes you don't have the opportunity to do some things that you should do. That's what musicians do, but there's no excuse. Go back and do the things you were supposed to do. One thing COVID did, which was a horrible thing, that what took place. But for me, it was a thing where, you know, I had to be at home, and it's the first time I had time off since I was for 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been grinding since I was 16 to 17 years old, and it's a constant grind, four kids, four grandchildren. Wow. So if it's anything, it's like I had a chance to go, okay, how's everybody doing? Who can we help? Who needs help? Mm-hmm. Let's look after those folk. Mom, dad, whatever, you know, things changed, people transitioned, but I was able to, you know, go, okay, I'm all right. Who needs help?
Yeah.
I'm okay. Who needs help? What can I do? What, you know, and it's not waving a flag. So the same Doug that was there then, I came from family and friends, and we always looked after each other. And those family and friends I still have to this day. So, you know, when there's people in need, you get together, you help them. You know, put yourself in the back burner.
Yeah.
Just help. So, yeah, you know, thank you, Doug, from the past. You know, and thanks to my family and those folks that I grew up with that helped me. I'm not the architect, I'm the recipient. It's not, you know, no, man, I had people help, and I appreciate their help, and I love that, and I appreciate helping other folks from the heart, not some, oh, man, look at what I'm doing, let me help that folk so I can get some more shine. Screw that. I want us, those kids that I saw today, that's coming from the heart. When I'm talking to them, I'm keeping it 100, you know what I mean, but in a way that I can connect with them, because I got kids.
Yeah.
They're the next generation.
Yeah.
You know, I want to see them on stage do their thing. Why not? You know, give them that knowledge. Share that. Look a person in the eye and have a good, honest conversation with them. Without all that, stars are in the sky and they fall out sometimes. So that Doug got me to this Doug, and I'm hoping that this Doug can keep going on, and whatever that Doug created for this Doug, I hope that information can be shared for the end of time.
Awesome, man. Well, I am so happy to be the recipient of today, the clinic. This has been special, and the gig tomorrow, I'm sure, will be heaps of fun. So I really appreciate you taking time. Amen. I know it's been a massive
thank day. You for what you do, sharing information, and also checking out and interviewing all of these great musicians and bass players, all mates, you know what I mean? We're all eating and breathing out the same air. Yeah. Thank you, man, because everybody needs that support.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Peace.